Hi, this is Dylan Cruz from the Permaculture Paid Forward Project, and you're listening to the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann. Peace.
Hello, Scott here. The interview in this show is with one of my teachers, Rico Zook. We met at the teacher training in Oregon along with Jude Hobbs and Andrew Millison. You can hear about that experience in the archives where I reviewed my trip. I wanted to talk to Rico because he spends his time as an itinerant teacher of permaculture. He travels all over the world, including India, Cambodia, the U.S., and recently Jordan, to instruct others, and along the way fosters relationships, builds community, and challenges his personal assumptions to connect with the students and their needs. We range over the topics here and there in the conversation, but begin with his introduction to permaculture in New Mexico with the Lama Foundation, and end with his thought for all of us, to look around and ask ourselves, what can I do better? Enjoy the interview.
I guess if we can begin,
yes.
Can you tell me, give me a little bit of background information on yourself, how you came to permaculture, what you've been teaching, and then why you chose to do international instruction?
A couple questions there. So coming to permaculture, it was more of a very natural aspect for me. It wasn't so much thinking about what I wanted to do. It was definitely later on in terms of was something I started out doing when I was a young man. There wasn't even that word then, actually. They were just starting to work on it. So really, when I first heard the word was in New Mexico, and that by that time I had had most of the parts because I'd been interested in outdoor stuff, botany and life sciences, and land restoration I had studied, and things like that. And so when I first heard the word, I had a lot of the parts. And from there, to me, the thing that's sort of pulled me into it is just how functional it is, just how it's fairly young, but in a way it's very dynamic right now in its growth and what it's doing and its potential. So that's sort of what hooked me with that, with when I first sort of got to know permaculture, the first 10 years, because I've really worked, when I first heard it, and then for the following 10 years, I was at the Lama Foundation, which you've heard me mention before.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that was more of, I was fortunate to have a single site that had been, unfortunately, the site itself had been burnt to a crisp, basically, from a wildfire that had destroyed 23 out of 25 or 7 structures, depending on what's considered a structure. And, 95% of surface was taken toast. So, that's what brought me to this place was reading about it and wanting to help and my own personal things I was interested in. And that's where I actually, in the rebuilding process, met my mentor, Ben Haggard, who works with a group called Regenesis out of New Mexico, Santa Fe. But he was involved up there. So that's when I first got that and then worked on for the next 10 years at the Lama Foundation to help rebuild it and reestablish it in a very northern New Mexico, cold, high, dry climate. So it was a good start.
So
fortunate to have a site. Yes, go ahead.
That time at the Lama Foundation, your 10 years there, gave you a lot of that on the ground, hands on experience with doing permaculture and regenerative design. And
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it did. Not that I have been as a mentor for myself and several of us that were going through the process and working with the site and in sort of. Helping mentoring us in the process of coming up with this, sort of a site plan that was fairly open-ended so that, we were able to sort of evolve as we, learned as we did stuff. So, yeah, I was very fortunate to have both a place, the Lama Foundation, and a mentor to, get myself grounded in my work in this thing we're calling permaculture.
From there, what made you transition then into teaching? Was it just a natural extension of all the hands-on work or?
The teaching part of it was actually more from just my life because my father was a teacher and my mom was a librarian. I came from a fairly literate family and I had taught different things as a young man. I studied martial arts a lot, so I taught that and I cooked and taught cooking and was sort of teaching people to cook as they were learning in the industry, as it were. So the teaching part itself was actually already there with me and being at the foundation. At the Lama Foundation, there was a lot of programs we did in the summer and a lot of volunteers. So it was in many ways a natural aspect of working at that site was teaching people about what was happening and why things were going on and what they were doing. And we also organized. There was a thing called Build Here Now that was in the late 90s and early in 2000, 2007, pretty well-known national natural building and permaculture thing that happened at the foundation. So I was involved in that too. So teaching was all the way through it with me and just sort of coming out of my father and such.
And you go from 10 years on one site building and teaching to now being kind of an itinerant permaculture teacher, spreading the word all over the world. I know when we spoke, you talked about having spent time in Cambodia and India and now in Jordan. Yep. How did you make that transition from being centered in one place to traveling and having this nomadic existence?
Yeah, it's kind of going opposite poles, that's for sure. I've always in my life had this sort of dream of traveling internationally, visiting other countries and, just learning and seeing and that type of thing. And wanting to do that with some type of more of an exchange as opposed to just a tourist model type situation. So I won't go into motivations, just personal stuff, but at one point after being at Lama for 10 years, it was just like, this is what I want to do now. I want to start doing this international work. So I chose India to just step out and do it. And I had a permaculture friend who had married and she was working in India. So he was there and he had actually worked at the foundation, Lama Foundation, as a permaculture person also. So I had a good connection with India. And so I just sort of took the step. For personal reasons, the time to do it. And I'm amazed at how it came out. I self-funded. I mean, the critical thing to understand about in terms of building what I did or doing what I'm doing, I don't work for anybody. I'm not employed directly as an employee of someone, as it were. I'm a private resource person, contractor, whatever you want to call it. So each thing I do is usually, most everything is with a different organization or individual or something. So, I self-funded for about the first 4 or 5 years in terms of doing work here in South New Mexico with a friend of mine who had a landscaping business for about 3-4 months of the year to then fund those my other time overseas. But now it's self-funded. Now I don't have to do that. But that was the step was a crazy one. It's one extreme to the next, but I sort of did it.
Having taught then in both the United States with your work with the Lama Foundation, your time on the ground, and then moving to the international scene, what kind of a cultural difference is that to move from the United States and in many ways like a Western mindset to India?
It took me definitely several years to figure it out in terms of how to convey ideas and also just the general logic of the culture and the the sort of way that people or that particular culture and the different cultural information, the perceptions of the world and things like that. It takes a bit. And definitely my first time when I went to India and did it for the first several years, it was, took me a bit. How to explain it? I mean, the thing that I've just come up with over and over again is not trying to be aware of my assumptions. Of when I'm going someplace for the first time, what assumptions do I have about the place? They might be somewhat correct, they might be totally off, but being aware of sort of what I'm bringing into it and then instead of what's there actually, sort of what the culture is like itself. Between Indian and American cultures, there are definitely some significant things and interesting, subtle things that could be, I don't know, how much time I want to go into that, but just learning about how to present these ideas in a way that a culture can grasp them as important or as useful for them. And that usually takes a few times to understand that. Like with Jordan, I just started working in Jordan and I'm just still in that process of understanding that one for them.
And as you learn more by spending time in those communities and teaching to them, you have new ways to present that material that then speaks to them in a way that's meaningful to their own existence. And not necessarily as the one of you as the outside instructor bringing your importance to it?
Yeah. There's two things there. Yeah, and the sense of what I'm bringing as what I think is important. And then just sort of understanding how it's sort of presenting the information in a way in which they can grasp it or see it. And it's sort of like that in the broad sort of mundane world of just sort of saying, as simple as as that goats are very dominant, cows aren't as dominant. You know, it's a very simplistic example of saying that, you know, in terms of examples, talking more about goats has much more relevance in Jordan than it does, you talk, depending where you are in India, where cows are much more relevant. And in Cambodia, cows are relevant, but they're not for milk. They don't milk or drink it. They just, it's more of a meat, for them in Cambodia. So just these different things like that, that's one level of understanding how to sort of present ideas and the symbols and the things that are relevant for that community. But there's a deeper logic too, which is the hard thing. That's a hard thing to express, sort of what does that culture hold important or of significance to them that gives them that sense of value for their day, for them as people, and understanding that in terms of the context of I'm a foreigner here who, you know, definitely there's need in their community for quality of life so they can be empowered to work and improve their quality of life. But then, yeah, the understanding of what that actually means, that quality of life, and how to, I'm sorry, I'm a little drifting there because it's a very subtle thing I'm still working with. I can't even explain it because it's on the one level, there's simple things like what's important in terms of what animals are dominant, what crops do they grow. Like Jordan, it's very big with olives, and there's this whole perennial setup that can be going with them. They're very dry land. And so there's certain things you can get on one level that, you know, with a little practice and going from that in terms of if you're doing what's this thing called itinerant permaculture, where you're taking something that's very site-specific permaculture and moving around with it, the skill base you have to develop of quickly understanding just sort of the basics of a place, their traditional practices, dominant crops, you know, building methods, traditional building methods like that. Go ahead.
With the idea coming from David Holmgren's principles of permaculture, of observing and interacting,
right.
Having to do that as you come into each culture, is it a unique experience every time, or now that you've been doing it for a while, do you kind of have like a mental checklist of what to look for and check off when you go in to find out both that surface understanding and then that deeper understanding for the community?
If I understand if you're asking about the different cultures I go to, there's sort of a yes and no answer to that, that there is yes in a sense, I don't know if I call it a checklist, but of an awareness of saying, okay, you know, like I was just sort of saying on one level, the dominant crops, the cultural practices, you know, sort of societal roles and different things like that. And then at the same time also, you know, trying to be aware of to help myself, you know, focus and observe better, but also trying to just keep that whole beginner's mind where, even though I had heard a lot about Arabic culture, even though I had heard a lot about the Middle East, that going there, it was just a totally different experience. Talk to people, firsthand experiences, people, family stories, people who are working there. And I was fortunate enough that the co-instructor at this course just did in Jordan at the PDC there. He's been doing a long-term project in Palestine and just his firsthand stories about day-to-day life there. So it's a balance of the yes and no with that question.
With those conversations that you had in the community, do those take a precedence for you when you go into a new area to just get to know the people who are there to adjust your assumptions?
You mean in terms of talking to the people in the village or wherever I'm staying directly and having conversations with them?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, oh, definitely so. And that's, unfortunately, you know, because of language, it's usually through one or maybe two other people. So there is a unfortunate limitation to it, but definitely, talking with the people is the best. And that's always, enlightening. And, yeah. I learned a lot. That's gold.
You mentioned having to go through a translator because of the language barriers, because not speaking the language. Has that ever turned into a bit of an issue for you to be going through someone as you're there? I've never worked directly with a translator, so I don't know what that process is like. I've had friends translate some things on the fly as we're listening to like a press conference by a foreign leader, and one of my friends happens to know the language, so they're translating for us while we're listening to it. But I've never had to try to have a dialogue with someone.
Uh-huh.
And what is that experience like, that time delay when you say something and something is translated to them and comes back to you? Does it wind up turning into a bit of a game of whisper down the lane as you try to develop these ideas, or?
Well, the translator is key, as you've probably, you know, just sort of was with what you were saying. And generally, once the process, once it's the transfer down the line of me saying something and translating it, not the way we tend generally think of it as telephone or whatever else. That's not generally the issue. The problem I've had, and it's definitely been a problem in a couple courses in the beginning, fortunately we were able to straighten it out, was that the translator just did not understand what I was talking about. And they were translating literally everything I was saying, just literally, but not grasping sort of the concepts I was trying to get across, the contextual part and other things. And I could tell for the first day and a half of this one course that the students were just totally bewildered and lost and just totally confused. And fortunately at this particular one, and this is in Cambodia, that I have a long-term student, his name is Huy Han, Mr. Han, a great guy, a very capable young man, and he's been with me for a few years. And he, gets permaculture, is really good with it. He's a good teacher on his own. He's a good translator, really young man. And so he's just starting there. And so because of saving face and cultural things, not interrupting or not trying to make someone look embarrassed, Mr. Han hadn't spoken up. But so I had to sort of take a little control and be a little forceful once I figured out what was going on. It was the second day. And then I was sort of just through various things, the questions that were coming back to me and other stuff, I was just really got it that the people were totally lost. So I had to sort of make the guy that was translating not speak up so much and have Mr. Han start talking more. And then within a very short time, within a couple hours, we got everybody straight. You know, you could just feel the whole place shifted once the translation got the meaning across and not, you know, just the literal translation. But Mr. Han started explaining the concepts and the wording, that. So my whole thing is if I'm going to work with someone who's going to be, you know, any type of training, that I have to meet them ahead of time and I really have to spend some time with them to get them a little bit more comfortable with the idea, which is much more difficult than just the languaging of it. Are you still there?
Yeah. In those cases, it's not just one of being able to, well, it's really one about communicating in the truest sense of the term.
Yes.
Because of how...
Yeah, and so...
Oh, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, yeah, because it's a lot about the conceptual understanding of a concept as opposed to just the wording, how we're expressing concept, but understanding the whole, you know, water catchment, processes between systems and the deeper layer ideas as opposed to just cycling water, but the deeper, that's the big challenge. That's the big challenge of translation. And with something like permaculture, that's not as common. If I was teaching business or economics or, it could be even typical agriculture on some sense, that we could have found a translator that could do it because that's normal in terms of Western culture and stuff as economics. Whole systems and talking about environmental things, that gets a little challenging time with the translation and the languaging.
In some ways, do you think that the Western society, the United States, the United Kingdom, Australia, that we're fortunate that the idea of permaculture was developed in an English-speaking country, that it was able to flourish in these areas so well?
Well, I think it was fortunate just that English is the international language now by whatever method it is, but English is the international language. So that permaculture was developed, and I think that's fortunate in that sense for anything to be developed in the accepted international language. But other than that, well, I think so because partly what's going on too, in many ways, Western culture is blessed to have the time, the money, disposal to be concerned with the environment. I mean, we're responsible out of the Western practices are very deeply responsible for the state of the world, as it were. And at the same time, because of our culture, there's an ability of people to have money and time to focus on these things. Where in a lot of cultures I'm working, it's just more about quality of life, feeding the family and getting an education to kids. So in that sense, I think permaculture might have only been able to be developed in a Western culture because of its that innate ability to have that extra time and money at your disposal. With that said, in India, there's been other agriculture, not as, because permaculture, as you know, we're aware, is more of a design approach, sort of a larger umbrella. than classic sort of farm system like biodynamics and other stuff. But there are in India, even there's some systems called zero import. It's not quite that, but it's like zero input farming that this man developed in sort of an indigenous permaculture out of this part of India. So there's people doing stuff too in their own cultures and calling it whatever that's happening.
With this idea of zero input and these indigenous ideas of permaculture, I know that there's, I believe it's...
Oh, sorry about that. Sorry about the noise from outside.
Okay. David Holmgren and Bill Mollison are considered like the founders of permaculture, but at the same time, it's Sepp Holzer, I think he's an Austrian?
Yeah, I think so.
That he's also seen as being one of the co-developers of this idea, and there's Masanobu Fukuoka's idea of natural farming, that all these things come together. As you move through the different cultures, do you see more and more of this that you go, oh, well, this is something that I'm familiar with, that you can then take back to students elsewhere and then add to the body of knowledge of permaculture as a result of that?
Yeah, I think there's some. I wouldn't say there's some. I mean, a lot of times when I see something that's pretty interesting or, you know, cool, you know, permaculture, you know, in the culture, I can usually see the underlying principle that permaculture already talked about or other systems, you know, whatever you want to call it, talked about. So, in that sense, a lot of times the expressions of things are unique and pretty cool in the way they're expressing an idea or working with a challenge that other, you know, like water and water management challenges, and just seeing how each culture sort of deals with it, but that the underlying things are often very, you know, very much within the principles and core understanding of permaculture. So that's a common thing for me. And so a lot of times it is, I guess, in a sense, it's, most of my itinerant work has been through the tropics. So that's an easy thing from one tropic to not easy, but there's, it's, you know, doable, translating ideas from India to Cambodia with some adjustments. But, now that I'm starting in the Middle East, that'll be a little different, a little bit more of a challenge.
You've been teaching in India and Cambodia off and on for a number of years now, as I follow. Have you been able to go back and see the projects that your students in those areas have been working on and implementing?
A little bit. That's sort of the unfortunate thing with what I've been doing. And one thing I'd like to change is that I'm really developing more long-term impact and keeping things sort of, once things get going, keeping them going. That's often the big challenge of this work. So a little bit, I've seen some of my own work with some restoration projects, worked with a couple of wetlands restoration projects so that I can go back and see, a couple of the farms. Well, there's small impacts on village life in terms of water heating and little things we've introduced that, you know, taken a little bit of a hold. So they're more of like small aspects of life in the village as opposed to the whole thing. It's a mixed bundle because there's also quite a few, in all honesty, of, you know, doing some work, getting some good things happening, having some good trainings, but then nothing really enduring that I can be aware of coming out of it. Change in funding, change in perspective with the organizers in terms of what they were wanting to do. So the thing that, and now, and this sort of related to what you're saying, is I have a couple of students in Darjeeling who I'm trying to work up to the big farmer training's great, and that's not a problem. We've developed quite a few good sort of 5-day programs, and they do that quite well. But now I'm hoping to get them to doing be able to teach a full PDC design course, so that's getting them experience. And so that's another sort of, in a sense, project. Is having seen them go through, and we just finished a design project for an ashram back there that they were the lead designers on. So that's sort of a big one there, trying to get experienced people.
So that you can get people trained up to the point where they're fully comfortable within permaculture to be able to take back to their own communities and share with others?
Yeah, exactly. And not just their own communities, more of India, which is a huge conglomerate of things. But definitely their own communities in terms of these folks, because, you know, India is so hugely diverse. These folks I'm thinking of in my home in India basically is Darjeeling, so it's a Nepali culture. And definitely there's been in that area some influence now in that, because we've been doing trainings and working They'll be doing the 10th annual Darjeeling Permaculture Design course this coming November. So in the hills there, yeah, definitely there's a growing awareness with them, but also hoping for them to teach in other parts of India.
You mentioned about how large and diverse India is, and there was when we've met and you were talking about teaching in India, you mentioned something about the large number of farmers in India, something measured on like hundreds of millions of farmers on, was it like 2 acres or less most of their farms are? Is that the right number or?
Yeah, okay. India's usually diverse, so there'll definitely be places with fluctuations in this. But the average farm size in India is somewhere from an acre and a half to, half an acre to an acre and a half, depending on the part of India you're in. So most Indian farmers just have a very small piece. And the other figure you may have been mentioning is that, 1 in 4 farmers in the world are Indian. They have 1.2 billion people, and I think a quarter of that, so, somewhere around 300 million people are farmers, or more than 400.
So we go from the United States. We have the United States that has a population of around 300 million, and India has that many farmers.
Oh, at least, yes. Yeah. There's more farmers in India than there are people in the United States, no doubt. So it's a huge thing for India in that sense, and with that.
So then their farming practices would still be very hands-on, not mechanized in the way that we think of in the United States, or?
Yeah, again, it depends where you go to, but the vast majority are using, especially that small of pieces of land, they're using mostly draft animals or human labor, human completely without any animal assistance. It's not uncommon. I mean, the image I give, this is a apt image for India, is that you'll have a farmer out in the field. There'll be a draft animal, bullock pulling a cart, which I've seen many a time, the plow, is with pegs. Guys out there plowing the field, doing this, and he talks on his cell phone. And that's sort of India, the cold, roots in the past, 1,000-year-old technology still being used to plow the fields, and the guy will have the cell phone and talk on his cell phone. So that's Indian farmer today.
It paints an interesting picture to imagine seeing that as you're walking along. There he is with his bull and his plow and chatting away on his cell phone as he's plowing that space.
A plow that could have been built, hundreds of years ago.
As you continue to grow and develop your experience as an itinerant permaculture teacher, what are some of the most common challenges you find if someone wanted to, if you will, follow in your footsteps and pick up one day and want to teach internationally?
It's getting the hands-on experience. I mean, I was blessed that I didn't think in, about 10 years ago that I'd be doing this. So I was just more living my life. And when I started this, I had a good, strong, lots of hands-on experience. And that's for the young folks, people just starting this, that's the hard part. Because they just have to get, because permaculture is so broad scale, and if you're working with different communities, even if it's water issues, that can involve food security, it can involve, social political considerations, it can involve a huge area of stuff. So the challenge for people coming into this is to have the patience to really build the hands-on experience and knowledge and background and just maturity to be able to do it on a, day-to-day basis in multiple different, I think this is what I'm doing after, in my mid-40s, and I was sort of, I think, mature and ready for it. I've had multiple apprentices, and I find that very few of the young folk are really quite ready for the depth of what's needed, which is okay, because it's an involved thing. Teaching and doing this just in your own culture is challenging. To do it on a traveling basis in different cultures, it's a fair bit that you have to deal with that can't really be articulated on different levels.
You just have to go out there in some ways, try it and see what works and what doesn't work for you?
Well, what I would say, first off, is you have to just get the hands-on experience. So whatever it is, if you're learning permaculture, if you're, learning about plants, soil, learning about the protect, the cultural, political stuff that you can just be informed about and be aware of, and just you can have some awareness of women's issues and just the way politics, traditional politics and stuff anyway. Yeah, you just have to build that up. And then at some point, you will start, because I would highly recommend that people work where they're at in this moment, wherever they're do the work there. Start at your doorstep. Once you get that experience and hands-on familiarity, then you can step out and step farther away. And eventually, if you make it, you will have enough of a grounding in order to do it. With that said, I mean, if you do have experience, you know, enough experience to be sharing stuff in terms of your good organic farmer, and you have, you know, other, you know, water skills and stuff, then it's just sort of the funding, you know, self, the step when you actually do it, once you sort of have or feel like you have enough experience, something valid and worthwhile to share. Yeah, being able to self-fund gives you a bit of freedom, which for India and Asia, and I haven't been to Latin America, but I'm at certain parts in Africa, that once you get past the airfare, then it's pretty easy.
And when you say self-funding, that's the idea of like working, say, in the States or whatever, wherever your home country may be, in order to raise the funding so that you can send yourself to the area that you want to go to with
yes.
enough resources to live for that time period
yes.
without trying to necessarily seek funding from an organization to pay your way,
right.
pay your own way, do the work on the ground, and then while you're doing that, foster the relationships that are necessary to build paying work.
Yeah, basically, if you're going to go into it that, you know, that depth like I have, then yes, that's sort of the route I took, was that I earned enough money here to buy my airfare and then have money to support myself while I was there. So through various contacts and just people who believed in me over there, who were like, yes, you know, this is a good thing, you know, and we're into it, just built my experience. You know, I'd be overseas, Asia, India mostly, but then Cambodia. And a few other countries around, for about, you know, 6 to 8 months, 8 months of the year. And then I'd work for 4 or 5 months and earn the money. And then that gave me the freedom, and people would say, of course, I'd say sure, and we'd set it up. And, you know, and then after I've learned and I've grown and stuff, then it's just sort of slow asking for travel expenses. And then now I can send you my charge sheet.
Okay.
You know, but it took me basically from when I was doing it, and I sort of, you know, funded myself, supported myself for the first about 4 or 5 years, until it sort of, after about 5 years, it started approaching paying for itself, you know, the 6th year or 7th year is when it really, you know, paid for itself.
Mm-hmm. It kind of speaks to that idea that it takes 10 years to be an overnight success.
Something like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's just so much to learn in doing it. And I think it's a good model too, in terms of self-funding, because it shows a good level of commitment. Because partly to do itinerant work, to do this type of work I'm doing, I tell people, and you may remember this from, when we were in Oregon, was just that you have to want to do this because this is what you want to do. Because you're doing it for yourself. You're not doing it because you think it's important work or you think it's like to save the world, whatever else. That if you're going to do this itinerant work, it's because it satisfies you, you know, it sort of feeds you in some way. This travel, this meeting people, this sort of doing the work that, you know, the work itself. And I do feel that's an important component to do it successfully. You know, that part of the person has to have that sort of, you know, that feeling to do it.
So that whatever situation you run into or whatever struggles you find along the way, that you can still wake up every morning and you're doing it because you're doing it for yourself. And that's what matters. And gives you that strength then to work through your issues and keep doing it and have that level of persistence to make it work.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, that's partly it. The thing when you said working through your issues and stuff, because it is, it's, you know, it has its challenges. There's a lot, depending on how you do it and how, you know, the way I've ended up doing it was as a solo person stuff. So there's a lot of challenges, just a lot of time, in that. So, yeah, in doing it because for yourself, because that gives you the strength to do it. And it is, because it's a mixed bag. There's a lot, just as much disappointment and just as much of like, am I really making a difference? Is this really helping? Is this, you know, what is this type feeling? So, doing it for myself, knowing that I can't think of doing anything else. I don't know what else I'd do. You know, that really helps.
With all the trials and tribulations of doing itinerant work and the travel and everything that comes with it, what have been some of your experiences that have really impacted you in a positive way?
Yeah, I'm seeing if I understand the question correctly in terms of just what has, just like the memories, the experiences that have.
Yeah, have there been any experiences that really touched you and took that personal reason for doing it and just gave you a certain level of satisfaction that you weren't expecting or didn't necessarily go seeking, but have come about because of what you've been doing? One of those moments, like when you really touched a student and made a difference in their life, or overcame one of those cultural barriers and something came together and brought you a certain joy on this road of travel and itinerant teaching.
Yeah, that's basically, I mean, you basically hit it in that sense. It's a sort of cliche thing, but it is so true, is that when I am aware of my contribution or what I sort of am doing, that it has affected someone, you know, that it has in some way shifted something for them. You know, and that's both with, sometimes when the farmer trainings, that happens, you know, you see the farmer sort of gets a aha moment or sort of, you know, feels emboldened to start experimenting and pushing boundaries. And then it also happens with, when there are more students who are, sort of going to work in terms of becoming permaculture people or becoming something more in that area. And then, you know, in some ways, it's just seeing the link, sort of the relationship between my teachers and myself and my students, sort of that continuum. And that a lot of times this knowledge or this awareness that we call permaculture, the things we call life, that it can, for me, there's this quality of linking that with some students I'll get. And it's hard to explain, but it's that,
There was something you spoke to when I took the teacher training with you and Jude and Andrew, where you said that every time that you work on a design, you work on designing yourself out of the system.
Right.
And I wonder, as a teacher, in some ways, are you trying to teach yourself out of the training, to impart enough knowledge and wisdom on your students that they can carry this forward without you needing to be there, where you can become the role of a mentor rather than always being an instructor on hand?
Yeah, it's like that. It's more though that the thing I was trying to get at, that that I see that the sort of the learning or the knowledge itself, that myself and my teacher and my students are just sort of subservient to it in that sense. It's a little sort of in that I'm not. It's sort of taking myself out of the teacher role. It's like teaching myself out of being the teacher, which I totally agree with. But it's sort of in the sense that it's, I don't know. Because to me, when that thing I describe about what I do, it's sort of a life systems designer. And it's both that I design life systems, if they be water processing or, you know, food production or whatever else that they're, you know, I design life systems, but also the systems that I design that aren't technically alive, or be it, you know, village organizations and such, that they're still modeled after life systems. So when I was thinking about the question, it's in that sense of just being part of the continuum, being part of for me, some of the biggest rewards, I guess, in that sense, is when there becomes this awareness in a situation, I'm talking to someone, either a student or my mentor or just somebody else, and that there's, now that I've lost the pace of it, to find that word.
That's all right. I've had plenty of experiences where I've lost my narrative thread.
Yeah, so I lost you right there with that one.
Yeah. No, that's okay. I still think that there's enough there to get a feeling for what you were going for.
Yeah. It was the sense of the teaching, and I didn't want to be too metaphysical. I was trying to not say that, you know, sort of this whatever, but the sense of that is, there's just a validity and a truth, and not that it's the ultimate truth or it's, only truth or anything like that, but just the sense of, no, this is like good. You know, what we're training, what we're learning, what we're helping people with, what we're doing now is good. It's empowering people. It's helping people with the quality of life, the planet. It's So it's just those moments of linking into this larger thing. That's sort of expressed through people teaching me and then me teaching others and this lineage. It's sort of those two combined that creates that.
As that goes from your instructor at the Lama Foundation to you, to your students, which at this point includes me, and all the work that we do from there, the way that that work continues to travel around the world.
Yeah, well, you heard me say this in the course we did, but in the PDC, when I teach the any course, I always emphasize relationships, you know, and it's all about relationships. Mm-hmm. And in this sense, I'm in here in Taos right currently just having a very short visit, and I saw him, Ben, my mentor. And it's always like we sit down and he really likes to make tea, so he has his little tea ritual and he's sipping our tea and talking. And it's always just like spot on. It's always just straight, just challenging me and asking me questions. And I always come away just my one day I have with Ben every year. I'm losing myself now again in the narrative, but, there's a linking of the humans and our human relationship and us sharing and passing along and building this truth that helps us live well on our planet with each other and the planet. So,
and just doing what we can to tie everything together.
Doing what we can. Yeah, that's all we can do.
Well, while you're in New Mexico and have some time off from teaching, I don't want to take up too much of it. I won't keep you much longer, but is there anything else that you'd like to say or share with the listeners of the show about the role of permaculture in the world or what it's like to teach permaculture or anything about itinerant permaculture?
Well, there's a lot within all of those categories, but when I'm sort of, something you want to say type question, the thing I just want to put out is that we're all in this together, and that, I don't really care if people use the word permaculture or whatever they want to call whatever. But the whole point of what's going on is that we all have to be involved in it. And if we're doctors or plumbers or farmers or work in stores or drive or whatever we do, each one of us has to be engaged at some level. And I just ask people wherever they're at, whatever they're doing, just to look around and say, what can I do better? How can I, live this life in a good way? And so that's just to me is the main thing. It's just like, everybody who ever listens to this, it's just what I ask them. Where are you? What are you doing? How can you do it better? How can we all, work together to make it, a good life on this planet? So.
And continue to improve that quality of life for ourselves and each other in the world.
Yeah. And we can do it at the same time. We got to start somewhere, and that's right with ourselves. But at the same time, as we're doing that, we can be, looking around us and see what's going on around us. And in terms of itinerant permaculture, that's my life and that's what I've chosen. And that I think, if we talk about itinerant, there's some specific aspects that make it interesting doing the thing called permaculture in a sort of place to place movement process. But that, everybody who starts zone zero, you start yourself, you start at your home. And then, as they say, the journey of 1,000 miles is starts with the first step. So, just doing it at your home, taking that first step is the beginning of a long and wonderful journey.
Well, Rico, I'd like to thank you very much for taking this time out of your schedule to sit and talk with me and share part of your story and your work and your passion with the world.
Well, thank you. I appreciate doing this. It seems like it's gone by pretty quick. I had fun talking at least, so hopefully some stuff got out there.
There's a lot of information in here, and I've got notes that I'll put together and include in the episode notes for people who might be interested in learning more about you, the Lama Foundation, Regenesis, and some of the other things that we've spoken about. And then once you get done with your 10th annual Darjeeling PDC and you're back around and we can hook up sometime, we'll talk again and you can let us know how that went.
Yeah. Well, my website has my, my schedule on it all the time. So that's going to get updated right now.
Okay.
Well, I appreciate it. And it's great talking with you. And how you doing?
Yeah. Take care, Rico. Be safe. And we'll talk to you again sometime soon.
Okay.
Yep. Bye.
Thank you for joining me for another interview. If you have comments or questions about this or any other episode, go to thepermaculturepodcast.com and leave a message or send me an email. That address is show@thepermaculturepodcast.com. Until the next time, take care of yourself, the earth, and each other.